Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's Waltham Council teleconference briefing on the fate of refugees amidst the current politicised debate. I'm joined here at the Waltham Centre by Jana Negroponte, public policy scholar and chair of the Waltham Council, and two of our in-house experts who will serve as our speakers for today's briefing. First, we have Roger Mark D'Souza, who's the Centre's Director of Population, Environmental Security and Resilience. Before joining the Centre, Roger Mark worked at Population Action International, the Sierra Club, and the Population Reference Bureau. At the Centre, he now leads programs on climate change, resilience, productive and maternal health, environmental security, and livelihoods. Also joining him is Joe Cassidy, who has recently joined the Centre as a Fellow, examining international refugee law, assessing its adequacy in the face of today's refugee mega-crises. Prior to the Centre, Joe spent 25 years in the Foreign Service. Domestically, he's also worked at the National Security Council, at the State Department's Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labour, and the Office of the Undersecretary for Political Affairs. Joe specialises in multilateral negotiations, human rights, and humanitarian response operations. We're very grateful to have both Joe and Roger Mark here today to take the time to speak with us this morning. And without further delay, I'd like to pass over to them to begin the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rachel, and good morning to all. Thank you for joining us today. As Rachel mentioned, I direct our programs here at the Wilson Center on Global Sustainability and Resilience, and I suspect that many of you are aware that the Wilson Center was recently recognized by the University of Pennsylvania as being the number one institute globally for transdisciplinary research. And I think this is really important because the topic that we will be discussing today is very much transdisciplinary in nature. And I think as we examine the issue around refugees and the political debate that we know is at the forefront of the newspaper headlines and in policy circles, we hope that we will be able to discuss with Joe today how this is linked to so many important key development and humanitarian issues. So Joe, welcome again. It's wonderful to have you here at the Wilson Center. And of course, I am personally delighted that you're part of the Global Sustainability and Resilience Program. And Joe, as you know, this is such an issue. This is an issue that is so much at the forefront of the headlines globally today. We see so many photos of refugees that are crossing the Mediterranean in overloaded boats. We see them penned up behind barbed wire in many Western European countries. When we look at UNHCR, so the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, they estimate that there are more displaced people in the world today than at any time since the Second World War. More displaced people in the world today. This is tremendous. It can seem as if the international humanitarian system is breaking down. What do you think? Do you agree? Where are we at?
I do. First, Roger Mark, such a pleasure to be at the Wilson Center and to get to work with you and the rest of our colleagues, so thanks very much for the opportunity. To go to your question, it does seem like important things are breaking down. So it's not just the total number of people that are forcibly displaced right now, as you say, largest since the end of the Second World War, 65 million people according to UNHCR. And it's not just that those people come from so many countries. It's not even just that those massive flows of people are so complicated. So the humanitarians would talk about mixed flows. These are presumptive refugees. These are economic migrants, people who are migrating for a constellation of other reasons. But I think one of the big concerns that I have, and we'll be doing some work on while I'm here, is the extent to which these big flows of people, especially into Western Europe and North America, and the reaction to those big flows are undermining our institutions in important ways and degrading our politics. And I think that's a big concern, not least because the advanced democracies in Europe and North America have been among the most, the strongest supporters of UNHCR in particular, and also the humanitarian effort in general.
So, Joe, you've covered a lot. Important things are breaking down. Massive flows are complicated. It's undermining our institutions, and it's degrading our politics. Talk a little bit more about that. What do you mean by it's undermining our institutions and degrading our politics?
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much. It's complicated because there's a bunch of things going on, but what I would say is it's not a surprise to say that in Western Europe and North America, there's a sense that our institutions are not coping very well with these massive flows of people. You know, you described some of the scenes in Europe, you know, huge numbers of people getting on leaky boats to try to make it to countries of first asylum in the EU. You know, these terrible places like the jungle in Calais, these sort of temporary transitory places that become more or less permanent. They're places that are pretty squalid and without hope. And in response to clear humanitarian needs, but also the sense that things are breaking down a little bit, you've seen the rise of demagogues who have identified refugees and other migrants as people worth resenting and fearing. So I think it's coarsened our politics. It's made our political debate less nuanced and less careful than it should be. And I think at the level of institutions, it's done real damage to the EU itself, obviously. It's also done damage to, the long-time American commitment to refugee resettlement, which is something else I've written on while I've been here.
So, you know, I'm really fascinated that during your time here at the Wilson Center, you are one of the things that I know you want to focus on is to look a little bit more about how we deal with this through international refugee law. I think the project that you're working on while you're here is called Revisiting International Refugee Law. So you talk about this connect on disconnect at various levels, and then you're focusing on the legal component of this. Do we need new international law? What would that look like? Is it a new refugee convention? Who should lead the effort diplomatically? What are you thinking of? What are you exploring with regard to a new international law?
Yeah, great questions. I'll try to start them, and you know a lot about this too, so please chime in if you'd like. So the first thing I would say is, in international law terms, the law relevant to humanitarian disasters, so international humanitarian law, refugee law, it's quite old. The Geneva Conventions date from 1948. The Refugee Convention dates from 1951. And, you know, no surprise that the way that conflicts are fought nowadays is much different from back then than the actors that we have fighting conflicts, the extent to which civilians are involved in conflicts, and then the ways in which people move around the globe right now are very different from 48 and 51. So the history in particular of the law of war over the last 175 years has been that it's updated every generation, and there's a reason for that, because the causes of all the potential problems are different with every generation. But one of the things that happened with the Geneva Conventions in 48 and the Refugee Convention in 51 is they were so good for their time that maybe there hasn't been there's been a little bit of a concern about how we would update those and whether any attempts to update them could actually damage the kind of principles that are embedded in them. So to give you a good example, when I run around the town and say what I've said to you, which is I think there probably could be some updates done to international law that would be useful for us right now, humanitarians sort of reel back in their chairs, and they're quite petrified that, especially now in this context, if we were to reopen international law, it would risk doing two things. The first, it would risk degrading the rights of victims, refugees and victims of law of war, and it would degrade the responsibilities of states. So I think that's, and I think, by the way, those are real concerns. All of us who care about these bodies of law should share those concerns. But I would say we're not, the choice is not between reopening the Refugee Convention itself or nothing. There are all sorts of sources of law related to humanitarian issues, and we could be talking about national law changes. We could be talking about international guidelines that wouldn't quite be binding, but that would still be relevant. We could be talking about regional arrangements, either regional conventions, so legal instruments, or something a little bit more informal. But I think there's a lot we could do. I think the law is a little bit creaky, and I think that does have consequences. One of the consequences in Europe has been that because the Refugee Convention doesn't specify particular processes for adjudicating refugee and asylum claims, it's meant that flows into Europe have gone predominantly to those countries with the most liberal laws, and there are consequences, the deleterious consequences, both for European countries and for the EU itself, to channel flows in very particular ways like that.
So I'm going to quote you on that, Joe. The law is a little bit creaky.
It is a little creaky.
So, you know, I really appreciated your teasing out how we deal with this issue at various scales. So you talk about international refugee law setting a framework. You mention international guidelines. You talk about the importance of regional arrangements. And then you say that we need to take this into consideration when we also think of national law. I know some of the things that we have been looking at my program here at the Wilson Center on Global Sustainability and Resilience is how do we navigate this complexity. And we look at that in the context of the environment and climate change. So we will be producing a paper that will be looking at the complexity, climate migration, and conflict in a changing world. But what we have found in that paper is that despite what we see in the news, most migration is south-south, it's internal, and it's conflict-free. So when we take that into consideration, and I see you nodding your head in agreement, we are thinking that because the vast majority of migration and displacement occurs within national borders, that what is really important is strengthening local institutions, including customary institutions, and connecting that to some flexibility in natural resource rights that might help ease the transition for both migrant and receiving communities. And as it's interesting to me as I think about this, because these kinds of recommendations seem to run counter to Western efforts where there's a call to clearly define exclusive rights issues, to really work to formalize institutions. So I'm struggling a little bit with this, appreciating and understanding what we need to do internationally. But if a lot of the conflict and contention around this issue is inherently so local, how do we bridge that gap a little? What do you think?
Yeah, great intro. By the way, just a segue, this is what I love about the Wilson Center, the fact that there's so many smart people and they approach all these issues from so many different directions. So great question. I will try to
it's
do
a great it. Place to be, isn't it?
It is a nice place to be.
You've landed well.
I'm very happy. So, Roger Mark, you know as much about this constellation of issues as I do. So let me start and answer, and then I'll, please jump in to agree or disagree or add something if you'd like. So something that we've talked about before, but several years before I left state, I went to a diplomatic conference in the Marshall Islands in the Pacific. And For those of you who haven't been there or don't know it, it's not a volcanic set of islands. It's a set of coral atolls. So most of it is about 2 meters above sea level, and this is, this one of the most tragic areas of what will likely be, you know, climate change and sea level rise. So people were thinking, are thinking already about the consequences of what it means if, you know, God forbid, a country is submerged or made substantially uninhabitable because its water supply dries up or is forced out or is salinated. It strikes me as a good way to think about all the questions that you asked just now, because as I agree completely, there's all sorts of levels. So on the, you know, at the uppermost level of sort of hard international law, people are right now looking into the term, you know, what exactly does a climate refugee mean? It doesn't have a specific legal context right now, but should it, you know, should we be creating new instruments to deal with this process?
And I guess the issue is that there is some inaccurate and simplified use of that term.
Exactly.
Right,
yep.
And that those who are displaced because of climate-related phenomenon are not protected by the Refugee Convention.
Exactly right. Yeah, the Refugee Convention has five areas of that go into the process of adjudicating asylum claims, and they are race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or holding of a political particular political opinion. So there's lots of stuff missing. And by the way, a quick segue. So, Roger Mark, if you and I were designing a new treaty from scratch right now that had human rights implications, we would think about a whole constellation of particularly vulnerable groups. So we would think about indigenous people and LGBT people and disabled people and, you know, unaccompanied children, things like that. They would be routinely the kind of things that we try to address in an international instrument. And not only are none of those in the Refugee Convention, but gender is not even there, and not just gender identity, but you know, persecution of women as a category for refugee and asylum claims is not there.
And why is it not there? Is it just because the law hasn't been able to keep up, which is what part of what you were saying earlier?
It is. I mean, 1951, the world was a very different place. Many of the countries that were negotiating this language, Saudi Arabia, for example, were not comfortable in having gender be one of the criteria. And nowadays, what we would try to do from the human rights side is we would try to find ways to make sure those terms were in there, whatever the, you know, whatever the opposition from countries that that were opposed. So to end the segue and go back, as you rightly say, there's no such thing as a climate refugee right now in international law. But, and this gets to your former question about levels, there are lots of ways that we can do things with legal import that will affect the legal rights of people that don't have to be hard international law. So they can be national law changes. And with regard to the Marshall Islands, one of the questions will be if, you know, again, God forbid, hopefully we can prevent this, but if the Marshall Islands are ever made uninhabitable, those people will go somewhere.
Yeah.
And there will have to be a legal process of determining what rights they have in whatever new place they find themselves in. So that's sort of international law, that's national law. And then you listed a number of different levels below that, often those levels are just sort of community engagement,
right,
or hosting or traditional practices. And my sense, frankly, Roger Mark, is that there are not enough people looking at those levels, lots of people looking at international law. And I think that's why it's so important that what, you know, your center is doing is bringing in these experts that have expertise in a bunch of different levels. So I think we're just starting to wrestle with it. And I'm not sure how much work I'm going to be able to do in my year here on that, but I think it's important.
I agree. It's always fascinating to me when we engage our colleagues who work on climate change issues who have been forced to look at this issue now, and very much they're framing this around questions of loss and damage. to what will be permanently lost because of climate change impacts and what will be damaged. And if somebody's land is lost and they're forcibly displaced because of this and they lose their ancestral land, and they lose components of their culture, how do you compensate for this? And how do you work this into international law? And what does it mean for refugee law? And how do you bring climate change specialists who are looking at these issues? So I think you're very right. It is quite complicated. I did want to go back to a statement that you made earlier, Joe, which I think is really important. And you say because of the debate around these issues, some people come away with the misperception that people, refugees, are worth resenting. And I want to talk a little bit more about that framing of these sets of issues from a rights perspective. I know that you yourself have written that if there is a program to resettle refugees in the United States, that it's going to be extremely controversial. When we know in Europe that there's a strong anti-refugee settlement, which we are witnessing as the worst kind of racism, Islamophobia and xenophobia in general. Where do you see this coming from? What's the genesis of this, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, good question. So I just, as you know, I just did an article in the National Interest, and what I tried to do is I tried to take issue with a lot of the things said about refugee resettlement, chiefly in this country, but the arguments are applicable to Europe as well. And I think, you know, let me start by saying the obvious, which is resentment of waves of immigrants is not exactly new in the United States. You know, one thing that we forget is it was anti-French sentiment that was one of the contributing causes to the Alien and Sedition Acts in the John Adams presidency. And we've seen waves of resentment and violence against German immigrants and Irish immigrants and Chinese immigrants and Slavic immigrants and Italian and Japanese and now Muslim immigrants. And we've seen the same thing, by the way, in religious terms. So throughout American history, there have been resentments of Methodists and Baptists and Catholics and Jews and Mormons and now Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
So to some extent, it's not new. But I worry now that the level of it is a little bit more extreme, and particularly compared to the last two generations in American history where refugee resettlement was bipartisan. It was supported by Congress, well, pretty well funded. We took in tens of thousands of refugees every year. They were sought after by mayors and governors across the United States, who, especially in places where there was not a lot of economic growth or population growth. So it's for me, it's this great tragedy that there's this program, long history of bipartisan support that's now political. And there's, you know, we could have another one of these sessions just devoted on the contributing causes to that. But what I would say is, whatever the substantive reasons for that people claim to support this resentment and fear of newcomers, it also can be mitigated by smart policies and principled politicians, and it can be exaggerated by bad policies and unprincipled politicians. So I think, you know, to the extent that I, average citizen, am not going to be able to reduce the scope for unprincipled politicians, what I want to do while I'm here is look at whether policy changes can help provide some insulation from this. So I'm going to be coming up with some specific ideas on the refugee resettlement issue itself, and you know, doing as much writing as I can before I leave.
So, you know, I think we're so pleased that you're here working on this because the timing is just perfect. And I would agree with you that the level that we're seeing right now is certainly more extreme. So the UNHCR, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, recently released a report looking at global trends on forced displacement. And they cited that there are three main reasons for the increase in refugee populations right now. They're long-term conflicts, such as in Afghanistan, that are lasting longer. So there are these conflicts, they're long-term, and they're protracted. Number two, that there's a dramatic new or reignited situations that are occurring more often. So they're lasting longer, we're seeing more of them. And third, the rate at which solutions are being found for refugees and internally displaced people has been falling. So it's protracted, it's happening more often, and we're unable to respond in as quickly as we need to. So I think that dovetails quite nicely with some of the key points that you made. I have lots more questions to you, but I want to ask you one more question, and I'm going to turn it over to Diane to see what questions she has. As you know, part of what we do at the Wilson Center is very much a focus on international, global development priorities in the spirit of Woodrow Wilson. So my program specifically works on a number of key international development priorities. And I'm always struck when I speak with my colleagues in the humanitarian sector who say to me that their charge is to respond. And when I seek to get to the root causes of some of these issues, they say to me, oh, that's a development issue. It's not a humanitarian issue. And I think this is particularly salient. We continue to see a sustained divide between the humanitarian and development communities. I wonder whether you could talk a little bit more about this, and what are your thoughts on this particular topic?
Yeah, I think it's real. I think you've identified something that's real and is a concern. It's funny because diplomatically, the international community spends a bunch of time on this issue. I think there's a widespread appreciation that this hardline division between development folks and humanitarian folks is unhelpful. And one of the things that happened, as you know, this past September up in New York on the margins of the UN General Assembly meeting, were two prominent diplomatic summits. And one of them will kick off this two-year negotiating process that, among other things, will try to address this divide. I guess I would say that in characterizing the divide, I'd want to be fair to both sides. So there's, you know, there with big organizations, there's always the potential for people to, you know, to be scuffling after funding and to have bureaucratic rivalries. There's all that sort of thing too. But there are a couple concerns that that folks from one side has about the other, and they're not illegitimate. So for development folks, they look at humanitarians and they say, ah, you guys never think long term. Mm-hmm. You're in there right away, but you're only dealing with the symptoms. And we development types, we're thinking 10, 20 years down the road, and maybe that's not directly applicable to now, but it's the important thing in the long term. And for the humanitarians, one of the things that they would say in response is, you development types, you're so used to working with governments over a long period of time, you get more comfortable working with not-so-good governments. And if we have a protection role that mandates that we speak out against governments and on behalf of victims, we're not quite sure that you development types are going to live up to that. So both of those are, as I've described them, are a little bit of a caricature, of course.
Yeah.
But they're real, and you know you know them at least as well as I do. That when you talk to humanitarians and development types, they think of themselves as fulfilling separate responsibilities and addressing separate needs. And the more accurate way I think you and I would describe this is there needs to be a continuum. and for countries going through protracted crises, that you know, we need to smooth the transition from humanitarian assistance to development assistance, and right now it's not as good as it should be.
And I think, you know, I really appreciate your framing of those issues, and I think what we have seen here at the Wilson Center, that it gets even more complicated. As you know, we very much engage the security community. So when we call on the military for humanitarian response, it brings an added dimension to these issues that complicates it in some regards. So a number of considerations for us. Just before we go on to Diana, I know you mentioned two summits,
yep.
And I think these are very important. Just say a little bit more about these two summits so our listeners are aware of what you're referring to.
Sure, and also in the interest of, like, you know, marketing, I will say that I did an article that was pushed out by the Wilson Center's new Security Beat blog on the two summits. So please, for folks who are interested, please see the Wilson Center website. You can see it there. So there were two. One was organized by the United Nations, and it, as I said, launched this two-year process, a process of negotiations between states. To address some of these big outstanding issues, and one of them is going to be the humanitarian development divide. So I think we'll be following that closely over the next couple of years. I think there's some room to be optimistic that it may achieve some things we want, but to be frank, I think big negotiating rounds of all 193 UN member states are often not the best way to get at humanitarian principles in an international law sense. So that's something we're going to be working with or following very closely. And then the second summit, interestingly, was organized by the U.S. government, and we ended up having about a half dozen co-hosts, other countries, that was an effort to do three things. So increase overall humanitarian assistance funding, increase the number of refugee resettlement slots in third countries, chiefly, in Western Europe and North America. And third, to provide greater work and education opportunities for refugees in their initial country of asylum, so often somewhere close to the country from which they fled. And that was an example, I would say, of very smart U.S. diplomacy. So we did a couple things. We said no one can come and have a speaking slot or a co-hosting slot unless they've made specific pledges that are actionable and that can be tracked. So to get in the room, people had to come up with money and resettlement slots and you know, provided greater opportunities, these educational and work opportunities. That was smart because it created some competition to get through the door. And the other thing it did was put us in a position to critique those countries and their pledges 6 months from now or a year from now and make sure that people follow through. And as you know from your long experience to the international scene, a lot of these diplomatic meetings result in lots of lofty pledges that are never fulfilled. So this gives us a tool to track those pledges and to, you know, expose countries to some diplomatic pressure if they haven't met their obligations.
Great, thanks. I have lots more questions, but I'd like to hear what questions others have. So, Diana?
Roger, Mark, and Joe, thank you very much. It's been a fascinating conversation which raises multiple questions. But I'd like to start with this one. The UNHCR has focused on returning refugees once the conflict has subsided. And I had the great experience as a 25-year-old working with refugees with World Relief in Central America. And I remember the pressure from UNHCR to prepare the refugees for the return. Does that politics still continue? Are the funds there to help those who wish to abandon Hamburg and return to safer parts of Syria? Is it real?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm sad to say that I'm not sure the situation is so fundamentally different from the you know, what you encountered in Central America. I think it's a big problem right now. So to give you a sense, so Roger Mark at the start talked about the 65 million people forcibly displaced around the world. The United States is by far the largest country that has that brings people in through a formal refugee resettlement process. The administration just announced a big increase this coming fiscal year to 110,000 people. So 110,000 people in the midst of a 65 million person strong displaced community. It's what that means in practical terms is the opportunities for people to get third country resettlement are very, very limited. So you're left with two other options. One is to provide for people in place in their first country of asylum, often quite near the country that they fled, and therefore subject to a lot of the same insecurity and underdevelopment issues, or to get people to go to return home. And I think it's a really smart question because it's something I've been thinking about for a while since I've been here. It's one of the central presumptions of those who negotiated the Refugee Convention in 1951 is that people would go home, right? The end of the Second World War, huge numbers of people displaced, but ultimately people went home or to a place where they settled in. And it's hard to say in 2016 that that presumption is at all alive and well now. So the big refugee crises that we're dealing with are no longer measured just in multiple years, but in multiple decades. And in certain cases, as with Palestinian refugees who fled in 1948, that refugee crisis predates the UNHCR, the Refugee Convention itself. So I think we need to rethink some of these presumptions. I think return is not a viable option for most Syrians, and probably won't be for a while. So what we need to do is find solutions for them, sort of temporary or mid-range, to help people in need. But then the bigger question is, are we, as a sort of, international community, is the United States or Western Europe, are we doing enough to forestall conditions that cause these mass flights or to solve the problems so that people can go home in short order? And, clearly I think we're failing at that. I think Syria is a good example. There's no likelihood that Syria will be put back together again anytime soon in a way that would allow, millions of people currently outside the country to go home. And I think, to go back to Roger Mark and I's our conversation just a little while ago, not only is there a divide between development types and humanitarian types, but there's a real divide between people who provide humanitarian assistance and people who look at the hard level levers of U.S. foreign policy or Western policy. I'm a huge fan of soft power. I think it's important. I think you can accomplish a lot, but soft power is not the only power that's relevant to some of these refugee-producing situations. So I think we'll have to think more seriously about what nation building looks like in crisis areas and how that can be accomplished in the midst of ongoing conflicts. Because to address the 65 million people as opposed to just the 110,000 that we can resettle in the United States next year, that's multiple orders of magnitude different.
But if I understand it, the 65 million includes economic migrants. We are not on refugees. This conversation has been on the subject of refugees. Migration for environmental reasons, for economic reasons, and other reasons is another subject, although closely related.
Yeah, good. I'm glad you clarified that, because it includes not just refugees and people fleeing for largely economic reasons, but also that number also includes internally displaced people. So people who haven't been able to cross an international border and who, frankly, may have more protection concerns than refugees do, right, because they haven't been able to get out. So yeah, these flows are messy nowadays. This is also one of the presumptions in 1951. One of the presumptions of international refugee law is that you could determine who people were. And now, especially with people flowing into Europe from, you know, multiple areas in the Middle East and North Africa, the things propelling them to flee are complicated, and part of the reason is protection concerns, and part of the reason is economic opportunities and educational opportunities and things like that. So I think it still makes sense to use the 65 million number, because those are the people that we need to deal with. And in dealing with them, as I said, I think it's not just enough to mobilize humanitarian resources. We need to look more seriously into things that look like nation building, to create countries that are sustainable and viable enough so that there aren't these massive flights of people.
So, Joe, I wanted to add a couple points to Diana's question to us with regards to looking at returning, the potential for refugees to return. Is it real? And it seems to me that there are two things that are clearly real. The first real thing is that these people are displaced, so there is always this desire to go back. Whether that is realistic and is feasible is another issue. But if they could go back, they would. So they have the concerns that I think Joe spoke about. That's the first real thing. The second real thing is that desire to return does not inhibit them from establishing new roots and being productive, engaged residents and citizens of where they resettle. We know that many refugees who spend a long time in refugee camps have developed what my colleague, who is a former refugee himself, and is a staff person here at the Wilson Center, has developed what he calls refugee resilience. And the components of this refugee resilience that he developed after spending more than 10 years in a refugee camp is what has enabled him to be a productive, engaged U.S. citizen today. He would love to go back. He gives back in ways that he can from South Sudan, which is where he's from. But today, he's a U.S. citizen who is contributing to our well-being and our economy. He's a former refugee, but he still gives back to where he's from. But he's present with us today. He's productive. He's engaged. And this is through the skill set and this resilience that he developed as a refugee. And I think it points to some of the policies that we need to think of when we have refugees in these camps. To what degree are we preparing them for where they will go next? And in a little self-interested way, how is this beneficial to us? Because these people will ultimately be our fellow U.S. citizens. So that's an important dimension to this issue that I think is sometimes missed when the debate becomes so politicized, and that is real.
Let's follow up from that, and the role of the former head of UNHCR to be the Secretary General of the United Nations. Tell us about Antón Guterres, what he did and what you hope he will do when he takes on the Secretary Generalship.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you both. And by the way, another commercial advertisement, you can also go to the Wilson Center site and see an article that I wrote on Guterres with some thoughts about what he might do on the humanitarian side. So both of your questions, I think there's a strong tie because Roger Mark was asking how we take advantage of people in often terrible circumstances. And one of the critiques that I've made of the international humanitarian system is that we don't do enough on refugee value. So we don't do enough to identify it, we don't do enough to enhance it, and we don't do enough to utilize it. So I think I'm going to be making some recommendations over the next year for policy changes that we can do to get at those things. But Diana, this opportunity, Antonio Guterres as Secretary General, I think is making humanitarians, putting stars in their eyes, because they really do see his long service at UNHCR, 10 years, a couple terms, quite successful. I think in general he's quite well respected, both for his confidence and for his principles. I think he was a real voice of moral authority through a number of these crises, and he can also run things. Perhaps even more importantly, he is a former prime minister, so has presumably lots of these political skills that he'll need when wrangling UN member states. So humanitarians are sort of starting to get excited about this, and I hope that they're also being a little bit realistic, because of course he's not running an agency anymore. He's Secretary General of the UN, which, as you all know, is not president or king.
He's the Secretary of the Security Council, not the General.
Exactly right, Diana. His legal responsibilities are much more constrained in that job with regard to the political activities of the UN than they were at UNHCR with regard to its humanitarian activities. On the other hand, he is wildly popular and respected, and has deep insight on the humanitarian side. So if you were looking for someone to parachute in and take seriously all these issues that we've all been discussing this morning, and to have some good ideas about how the organization could be changed to work better, Antonio Guterres would be the perfect person, right? Like he's the guy that we would want in charge. So I'm hopeful that he'll have a good tenure. I think I wrote in the article that UN Secretary Generals are like new cars, and once you drive them off the lot, they lose a lot of their resale value immediately. So hopefully his honeymoon is a little bit longer than that. But it's a tough job, but I think he's well placed to see the challenges that we've all talked about this morning and to have some good ideas about how to fix things.
So, Joy, I need your help. Late last year, I was at an international conference. It was called the International Planetary Security Conference. It was held at the Peace Palace in The Hague, and I led the subgroup for Africa. And we were looking at issues around conflict and natural resources and displacement for the continent, and we ran a simulation with diplomats in the room. And everyone understood these connections. And those of us who were American in the room said this is very much in the framing that we talk about in the United States, from development, defense, and diplomacy, these three D's. And the diplomats, and these were many of them were Western diplomats based in Africa who were at the front lines of these issues. And they said to me, you know, Roger Mark, this is all well and fine, we get this, but where we struggle is we need more diplomatic tools. We need to expand our diplomatic toolkit. And it's a task that I'm trying to figure out myself. But I wonder, do you have any thoughts on what are potential diplomatic tools for those diplomats on the front lines of these issues? You know, they've come to an increased understanding, they see it's complicated, they recognize the legal dimensions and the other dimensions we spoke about. Any thoughts?
Yeah, a bunch of thoughts. So thanks. I'll say that Rosa Brooks, the Georgetown professor, wrote an article several months ago, and I'm going to get the title wrong, but it's something like defense is everything and everything is defense or something. And what she was critiquing was this movement in the USG over the last decade or decade and a half to charge the Pentagon with more and more things that traditionally were civilian
right.
things. And I think this goes along with, candidly, some a diminution of states' role in the interagency system. And again, over the past two administrations, this is not necessarily a partisan issue. But I think state needs to be better at what it does, and it needs to do more than it does. So after I left state, I did an article for Foreign Policy on state reform, and I'm actually doing another one for an Italian foreign policy magazine within the next couple of weeks. And so your question was perfect. So thanks for the kicker. But you know, the State Department needs to be better at what it does, but it needs to do more. And it's not enough to have the Pentagon responsible for things that look like nation building. That's not what the Pentagon is for. It's the Pentagon is not necessarily the best position to do that.
Yep.
And we need civilians in charge of those efforts. So in terms of building foreign institutions, in terms of establishing mechanisms to ensure that foreign governments are behaving as they should. Those are largely diplomatic functions, and I think it's been a real mistake to offload a lot of those things and operational issues too to the Pentagon.
I want to pitch in here too. I've been closely associated with the State Department for 40 years. A limitation that exists at the moment is that the U.S. diplomat sees his counterpart as being another functionary in the government to which he's assigned, as opposed to recognizing that civil society may be working in conjunction with his efforts. I'm going to give you an example of this. I spent time down in the barrios of San Salvador, some of the least secure parts of Salvador. I bring the diplomat in to come and see, to understand, to know the nature of the police. That diplomat, number one, is frightened to go there. Second, the security officer said, don't
right.
go there.
Yeah.
And then when they get there, they don't know how to interact with grassroots organizations who are, in fact, carrying out the very policies that the U.S. government has assigned to that diplomat. So it's training our diplomats to be more open-minded, to recognize they're part of a larger society, and to embrace grassroots, ordinary people, as opposed to just the functionary in the other government.
Yeah, exactly right. Let me jump in and say, like, I had a wonderful quarter-century career at the State Department. I love it as an institution. I was proud to be in the Foreign Service, but I don't think we're good enough. And Diana, you identified one of the chief ways in which we're not good enough, and that's you're exactly right. The State Department now is structured as not as a foreign policy institution, but as a diplomatic institution. So it deals with diplomats. It it takes a government-centric view of other countries and the world. Because of the real security threat out there, we build gigantic embassies with huge walls that are separated from foreign societies. And as you say, there's a lot of security professionals in the State Department who are legitimately trying to protect people who, in effect, prevent people from engaging with foreign peoples as much as they should. So, I'm I suspect on the same part of the spectrum as you are. I would like to see our diplomats get out and deal with real people more, and realize that foreign societies are not just their governments, and some cases they're not at all their governments. But a consequence of that is that more diplomats will be in unsafe places and situations, and will have to accept a certain rate of casualties among diplomats that so far we haven't been willing to do. I think that's the way our diplomacy should function, and diplomats, like soldiers, should expect a certain level of danger in their lives. But it's a little bit different from how we're running the ship right now.
Now, Rachel, you've told us, I think, that we're coming to the end of our hour.
About 2 minutes left.
All right. Roger Mark, your last comment.
As we wrap up, Joe, I just wanted to quickly ask you for personal reflection. What do you know now that you wish you knew 10 years ago that might have affected how these issues have come to the fore?
I think one thing that that not too many people appreciated sufficiently 10 years ago that maybe we do a little bit more now is that there are, even in successful democracies, there is a certain carrying capacity for social change over short amounts of time, and that with principled politicians and with good policies, you can increase that capacity. So you can make people feel secure, and you can give people a confidence that government is competent, and you can create economic systems that are not merely zero-sum, and you can create a sense of national identity, and you can explain the policy choices that you make, and you can expand that capacity. On the other hand, you can also have bad policies and unprincipled politicians, and you can degrade that potential. So you can set up economic systems that do look more zero-sum, and you can contribute to people's sense of fear, and you can convince people that government is not competent to fulfill its basic functions. And you can have unprincipled demagogues running out there, you know, inciting people toward toward people who are different. So I think, for me personally, I think, and I think more broadly, if people had understood properly that that social compact is potentially brittle, even in otherwise successful societies like ours, I think we would have realized that we had a greater responsibility to oppose those bad policies and unprincipled politicians, because the consequences are so dangerous.
Wonderful. A wonderful, very thoughtful answer.
Okay, well, I think we're basically finished. Thank you again to Roger, Mark, and Joe for joining us and giving up their time to speak about this very timely topic, and to Diana for your insightful questions. And our next Wilson Council briefing will be on December 6th with the Middle East program. So until then, thank you very much.